With me, definitely. Could I have your aunt's address? The detective asks Paul. Robert Pierce is at home Saturday morning, enjoying a cup of coffee when he hears his doorbell ring. He goes still. He decides not to answer it. Maybe whoever it is will go away. But the doorbell rings again, insistently. He thumps his coffee down, annoyed, and walks to the front door. He doesn't want to talk to anyone. He opens the door and sees a pleasant-looking older woman smiling at him. "What do you want?" he says curtly. "I'm sorry to bother you," the woman says. He looks back coldly at her. Does she honestly not know that his wife has been murdered? But she blithely carries on. "My name's Carmen. I'm a neighbor of yours. I live at 32 Finch, one street over." She points over her shoulder. He begins to close the door. "I was broken into recently," she says hastily, "and I'm trying to find out if anyone else was as well." He stops. He remembers the letter, the unexplained fingerprints in his house. He thinks about Amanda's phone, how he'd found it on top of the envelopes in his drawer when he was so sure he'd put it beneath them. He wants to hear what this woman has to say, but he doesn't want to let her know that he was broken into, too. He has already destroyed the letter. What if the police find out? What if they find out who it was and ask him what he saw in Robert's house? He shakes his head, frowns. "No, nobody broke in here," he lies. "Well, that's good, I guess," she says. She sighs rather dramatically. "Somebody broke into my house, and I'm going to find out who." She holds up a piece of paper. "I got this letter." "May I?" he asks. She hands it to him. He quickly realizes it's exactly the same as the letter he received. "When did you get this?" he asks. "I found it last Monday morning. It was pushed in my door slot." He looks up and hands it back to her. "How unusual," he says. He can't think of anything else to say. She snorts. "You could say that. I don't know how unusual it is for kids to break into houses, but it's pretty unusual for the mom to write an anonymous apology letter." She adds, "I can't find anyone else who got the letter, but it clearly says there were others. And I bet this kid has broken into more homes than just the ones his mother knows about." She sighs again, heavily. "I suppose I should just let it go. Nothing was taken, and the kid's parents have obviously dealt with it." "Just some dumb teenager," Robert says, careful not to show how uneasy he feels. She leans in conspiratorially and says, "Actually, I'm pretty sure I've figured out who it is, and from what I hear, he's got some pretty good tech skills." "Really? Who?" Robert asks casually, but he's thinking, what if the kid looked inside the phone? "If I find out for certain, I'll let you know. He snoops into my life, I'm going to snoop into his, and then I'm going to tell him what I think of him." Robert nods. "Have you gone to the police?" "No, not yet. I doubt they'd take it seriously." "Probably not," Robert agrees. "Well, keep your doors and windows locked," she says, turning away. Robert closes the door and begins to pace the living room. Fuck. This fucking teenager. What if the kid looked in Amanda's phone and saw what was on it? He writes down Carmen's name and address before he forgets them, and if he thinks he needs to do something about this kid, he will. Raleigh looks on in surprise at the scene in front of him. He's never seen these two official-looking people sitting in his living room before. What are they doing here? Adrenaline shoots through his body. This must be about him, about last night. "Raleigh," his mom says, obviously startled. "What are you doing up?" He'd gotten up early on purpose. It's not even noon, all part of trying to get back on her good side so he can get his phone back. But right now, she doesn't seem very happy about it. "We're finished here anyway," the unfamiliar man says, flashing a dismissive glance at Raleigh. Nothing to do with him, then. The relief almost makes Raleigh's knees buckle. Raleigh realizes he's in his pajamas, and everybody else in the room is fully dressed. Well, he didn't know anybody was here. He slinks back into the kitchen, relieved and embarrassed, while his parents show the visitors to the door, somehow aware that he's stumbled into something that he's not really supposed to know about. He pours himself a bowl of cereal and waits. He hears the front door close. His mom and dad don't come into the kitchen immediately. They're obviously discussing what to say to him. Finally, they join him, and his mom busies herself tidying up. There's an uncomfortable silence. Nobody says anything for a minute, and Raleigh wonders if they're just going to say nothing at all. Screw that. What was that all about? He asks. His mom looks anxiously at him and flashes a glance at his dad. It's complicated, his father says with a sigh, sitting down at the kitchen table. Raleigh waits, his body tense. A wave of anxiety comes over him. His dad says, those were the police detectives investigating the murder of Amanda Pierce, the woman down the street. He stops there, as if he doesn't know what on earth to say next. Raleigh can feel his heart thumping. He looks at his father, then at his mother. She's silent, wary. He turns his attention back to his dad. He's never seen him at a loss for words before. Why were they talking to you? Raleigh asks. He's not stupid. He wants to know what's going on. It's just routine, his dad says. They're talking to lots of people who knew Amanda Pierce. I thought you didn't know her, Raleigh says. I didn't, not really. She was a temp at the office sometimes, so I knew her, but not very well. She never worked in my department. Raleigh looks at both of his parents. He senses there's more they're not telling him. Look, Raleigh, there's something you should know, his dad says carefully. Suddenly, he doesn't want to hear it. He wants to be a child again and run from the room with his hands over his ears and refuse to listen to what his dad has to say. But he can't. He's not a little kid anymore. His father gives him a man-to-man look across the kitchen table and says, I saw Amanda carrying on with someone at the office. It was improper. I warned both of them to stop it. Someone else saw me arguing with Amanda about it and put two and two together and got five. I've told the detectives the truth. I wasn't involved with her in any way. We weren't having a relationship. I don't know who killed her. We can leave that up to the police to figure out. Okay? He adds, there's nothing to worry about. Raleigh stares at his dad, disturbed by what he's just heard. He's pretty sure his dad's telling the truth. He can't think of a single time his dad has ever lied to him before. He sneaks a glance at his mom, but she's watching his father, and there's anxiety written all over her face. She doesn't look like she thinks there's nothing to worry about. He wonders if he can trust his dad. Raleigh nods, frowns. Okay. His mom says, looking directly at him, I don't think this is something anyone else needs to know. Raleigh nods and says hotly, I'm not going to say anything. Then he retreats back upstairs to his room. After driving in silence for a while, Webb turns to Moen and says, he turned his phone off. Moen nods. Right, Webb says. We'll get his phone records, but I bet we'll find a call from his aunt that day, if she calls him every day anyway. She lives out that way. She lives alone and has a bad memory. She's confused. What if he was relying on all of that, for his wife at least, and went out that night and met and killed Amanda? We can't trace where he was if his phone was turned off. It's possible. Moen agrees, but we haven't actually established that he was seeing her. But it's possible. Becky Harris thought he was seeing her. Moen nods and says, his wife looked worried. What is she so worried about if he just went to visit his aunt? We should get him down to the station. Webb says, see if we can get anything else out of him. Chapter 23. When the detectives return to the station, there's news. We've got something, a young officer says, approaching them. He's one of the uniformed cops sent out to canvass the city and its surrounding area. We found a hotel where one of the clerks recognized Amanda's picture. She came there occasionally with the same man, and then we looked at the security camera footage. And? Webb asks, feeling an uptick of excitement. You have to see this, the officer says, and leads them to a computer. They look down at the screen. The quality is quite good. Webb sees Amanda first, flicking her hair over her shoulder. Then the man with her comes into the frame. He retrieves his credit card at the desk and then turns, his face caught squarely by the camera. Larry Harris. Well, well, Webb says. He glances at Moen. See how they're coming along with the security cameras at the resort. We need to know if Larry Harris's car ever left. Raleigh is no longer grounded. His mom couldn't stand him moping around the house without his phone and the internet to keep him busy, so at least he's allowed to leave the house again, not just for school and practice. He heads out on his bike, cycling around the neighborhood, trying to work off some of his stress. Without the internet, there's not much to do at home, and he had to escape the tension in the house. He cycles down the residential streets, past some of the houses he's snuck into. He almost got caught last night. That's it. He has to stop. It isn't worth the risk anymore. Breaking and entering? Messing with people's computers? Even though he's not actually stealing anyone's account info or distributing malware or porn or anything, he's not tampering. What he's doing is still a crime. The cops won't care that he's just doing this stuff for fun. He rides slowly past the Pierce place, glancing at it as he goes by. He remembers being inside that house, how clean it was, how orderly. Maybe because there were obviously no kids living there. While he was on the computer, he'd glanced through the desk drawers and found a cell phone at the bottom of one of them. It looked like a cheap, pay-as-you-go phone. Maybe it was an old one, or a spare. He'd turned it on. It had a charge, but it didn't really interest him, so he turned it off again and tossed it back in the drawer and soon left. Later, when he'd learned that the woman in that house had been murdered, it gave him a chill. The police must have found the phone when they searched the house. His one worry now is that his fingerprints are all over that phone, and in that house. He picks up speed, thinking uneasily about the woman, Carmen, and the letters. Raleigh's starting to understand that everyone has secrets. He's seen what some people keep on their computers. Nothing really surprises him anymore. Raleigh has secrets, and his parents obviously have theirs, too. Perhaps he should be snooping in his own house. It's Saturday afternoon, and the tension in the house is driving Olivia mad. Paul is upstairs in the office. Raleigh has gone off to his room. Olivia tries to talk herself out of going over to confront Becky. She's worried about what exactly Becky might have said to the detectives about Paul. Does she know more than she admitted to Olivia? Did she make things up to take the attention off her own husband? Has Becky been completely honest with her? In the end, she can't stop herself. She grabs a jacket and leaves the house without telling anyone where she's going. On the walk over, she has a crisis of confidence and half hopes that Becky is not in. But Olivia keeps going, even though it makes her sick that she's left her own house and is going to see Becky to try to find out information about her own husband. She feels lately that everything she took for granted, her good son, her faithful husband, has to be reevaluated. As she walks past the Pierce residence, she stares hard at the house. The blinds are all drawn, giving the house the look of a blank stare. She wonders if Robert Pierce is in there, behind the blinds. Suddenly she hates him, and Amanda, too, for coming into their quiet neighborhood and rocking it to the foundations. He probably killed his wife, she thinks bitterly, and they are all suffering for it. As she walks up the driveway and to the front door of the Harris's place, a cute house with dormer windows, she has a bad moment when she realizes that Larry might be home. He won't be at the office on the weekend. She doesn't want to see him. She rings the doorbell and waits nervously. Finally, she hears footsteps and the door opens. It's Becky. She's obviously not expecting visitors. She's wearing yoga pants and a long t-shirt that looks like she might have slept in. Hey, Olivia says. Becky doesn't say anything. Can I come in? Becky seems to be considering it, then pulls the door wide. Olivia enters the house, her nerves flaring. Is Larry here? She asks. Did you want to talk to him? Becky asks in surprise. No, Olivia says. I just want to know if we're alone. He's not here. Olivia nods, sits down at the kitchen table. Becky doesn't offer to make coffee. She just stands there, her arms folded in front of her. "We need to talk," Olivia begins. Becky just stares at her and waits. "I need to know if you've told me everything."
"What do you mean?"
"You implied Paul might be having an affair with Amanda. You saw him in her car." Becky nods. "That's true, I swear. Is there anything else that you know or saw that you're not telling me? Is there anything else you told the police? I need to know," she says. Becky takes a deep breath and exhales.
"Olivia, we've been friends for a long time. I've always been honest with you. That's all I saw, just that night, the two of them in the car, arguing. I assumed they were having an affair because why else would they be there at that time of night? And you know what a siren she was. Maybe I was wrong. That's all I know, and that's all I told the detectives."
Olivia exhales loudly, puts her hands over her eyes, feels herself tearing up. She nods.
"You want coffee?" Becky asks.
Olivia sniffs and looks up and nods again, suddenly unable to speak. She's so glad that they aren't going to be enemies. As Becky prepares the coffee, Olivia wipes her eyes with her hands and asks, "Have you heard anything more about the investigation? Do you know what's going on?" She doesn't want to ask directly about Larry. She waits to see if Becky will confide in her. Becky finishes with the coffee machine and turns around and leans against the counter. She shakes her head.
"No, I don't know anything. They're not saying much, are they? There's nothing in the news, either."
"I hope they figure it out soon," Olivia says, "and that this will all be over." Becky pours the coffee and carries the mugs to the kitchen table and sits down.
"Olivia, I'm not trying to convince the detectives there was something going on between Paul and Amanda. I told them what I saw. It's up to the detectives to find out the truth. I'm not out to destroy your life to protect my own. I wouldn't do that."
Olivia looks at her gratefully.
"Why are you so worried about Paul?" Becky asks.
Olivia flushes slightly and says,
"They were over at the house this morning, those two detectives."
"Really?" Olivia nods.
"They wanted to know if Paul had an alibi."
Becky stares back at her.
"And does he?"
"No, not really," Olivia admits. "He was visiting his elderly aunt, and there's no way she'll remember it and be able to vouch for him." Olivia adds nervously,
"She's got dementia."
She doesn't mention that Paul's cell phone was turned off that Friday night.
"Looks like we're kind of in the same boat," Becky says.
"Larry doesn't have much of an alibi either." Olivia looks at her, expecting more.
"He was at a conference at the Deerfields Resort that weekend."
She hesitates and then says,
"You know where that is?"
Olivia nods.
"But that Friday, he went up to his room and did some work and then fell asleep and missed most of the reception. So he doesn't have anyone to vouch for him, either."
Robert Pierce paces restlessly around the house as evening closes in. He thinks about Larry Harris next door. Does he miss Amanda the way Robert does? He feels a cold, hard hatred for Larry Harris. He wonders how Larry felt when he found out that his wife had been sleeping with his next-door neighbor. Robert already knows how that feels. He wonders how Larry feels now, with the police snooping around asking questions. Robert knows what that feels like, too. Robert thinks, too, about the other man that Amanda was seeing. Have the police found out about him yet? And he thinks about this kid who broke into his house, worries about whether Carmen will, in fact, go to the police about it. Next door, Becky has the local TV news on in the kitchen while she prepares supper. She hears the name Amanda Pierce and realizes that her shoulders are hunched up around her neck. She's holding her entire body so tightly that it aches. She takes a deep breath and consciously lowers her shoulders. This can't go on. She mutes the TV. She has changed over the last few days. She thinks of herself a week ago, how silly she was, with her girlish fantasies about her next-door neighbor. She's not silly anymore. Amanda is dead, viciously murdered,
And as far as she can see, the two most likely suspects are Robert Pierce and her own husband, Larry. The infatuation she'd had for Robert Pierce has fallen away since he'd grown cold to her, and since she realized she might have been used, that Robert might only have slept with her to get back at Larry. Had he known? And if so, how? Had Amanda told him? Had she taunted him with it? Or had he followed her and seen her with Larry? Was Robert ever attracted to her at all? Now, when she thinks about Robert, she doesn't think of his sexy smile at her over the fence, or of how he was in bed with her. Instead, she remembers how he spoke to her that last time over the fence, how smoothly he told her that he hadn't suspected Amanda was having an affair. But he was lying, and they both know it. He knew Amanda was having an affair, and she thinks the crafty bastard knew exactly whom she was having an affair with. He just wanted to be sure she wouldn't tell the police. Maybe she should. She has too much to lose if her husband is hauled through the criminal justice system. She has her children to think of. She can't let this destroy them all.
Saturday night, the usual strife. Glenda rattles around the house, feeling like she's jumping out of her skin. She'd tried to get Adam to stay home and not go out tonight. She's worried he'll drink too much again, do something impulsive, something they'll all regret. She'd enlisted Keith's help, but he'd been just as ineffective as she was. Adam doesn't listen to either one of them anymore. Keith avoids her, and she wanders around the silent house, waiting anxiously for Adam to come home. On Sunday morning, Webb and Moen are at the station when one of the officers approaches Webb and says, "Sir, there's a Becky Harris here to see you. She says it's important." They escort Becky Harris into an interview room. Webb notes the change in her. The first time she came to the station, she was nervous and tearful, afraid that her marital indiscretions would become known. Now she looks more composed, more wary, like she has far more to lose, or like she has something to bargain with. "Can I get you anything?" Moen asks. Becky shakes her head.
"No, thank you."
"What brings you in?" Webb says as they all sit down. She looks briefly uncomfortable, but she meets his eyes and says,
"There's something I didn't tell you before."
"What's that?" he asks, remembering all the other things she didn't tell them before. That she and Robert Pierce were lovers. That she'd seen Amanda arguing with Paul Sharp. What will it be today?
"It's about Robert Pierce."
She flicks her eyes nervously between him and Moen. "Go on."
"That night we were together, on the Saturday the weekend that Amanda disappeared, he told me that he thought his wife was having an affair."
"Why should we believe you?" Webb asks. She's obviously startled by his tone. What had she been expecting with her track record?
"Because I'm telling the truth," she says.
"You said you were telling the truth before, too," Webb points out, "when you told us he never said anything to you about suspecting his wife." "What's changed?" Perhaps, Webb thinks, her husband has confessed to the hotel visits with his lovely neighbor. She gives him an annoyed look and takes a deep breath.
"He told me not to tell you. He was rather intimidating about it."
"I see."
"He made me promise not to tell. It was more like a threat." She leans forward. "So you see, he did think she was cheating. He had a motive."
"I thought you said he wouldn't be capable of killing his wife, that he wasn't the type," Moen says.
"That was before he threatened me,"
Becky says, sitting back and glancing at Moen.
"I saw another side of him. He was different. He scared me."
"Anything else?" Webb says. She looks back and forth between him and Moen and says,
"Are you even interested in him as a suspect?"
"We're interested in lots of people," Webb says, "including your husband."
"That's ridiculous," Becky says, bristling.
"Not really," Webb says. "You see, we have security footage of your husband taking a room at a hotel with Amanda Pierce. On multiple occasions."
Becky stumbles out of the police station. For a minute, she can't remember where she parked her car. Finally, she finds it with the help of her keychain fob. She gets inside the car, out of the wind, and locks her door. She stares out the windshield, seeing nothing, breathing rapidly. The police have video of her husband with Amanda Pierce at the hotel. She knew this would happen as soon as he told her. The police aren't idiots. But that stupid bastard she married is. She has to find out the truth. She has to know, one way or another, what happened to Amanda. And then she will figure out what to do. She stifles a sob in the front seat of her car. How did she get here? She's just an average woman, married, with two almost grown kids, living in the suburbs. It's unbelievable that she's caught up in this nightmare. A woman she barely knew has been murdered by either her own husband or Becky's husband. If it was Robert, she no longer cares. No, she hopes he's caught and convicted, the bastard. If it was her husband, Larry, she can't even think about that right now. Chapter 24. Early Sunday afternoon, Carmen finds herself going for another walk around the neighborhood. She spent the last week talking to everyone she can about the break-in, in the grocery store, at her yoga class. She's frustrated that nobody else admits to having been broken into. It bothers her that she appears to be the only one. Maybe it was a lie that there were others. Maybe it was just her. Maybe she has been targeted, the object of some kind of prank. If so, it makes it more personal. Is it, she wonders, because she's new here, an outsider? She's more determined than ever to turn the tables on this teenage creep. She's pretty sure that Olivia Sharp is the woman who wrote the letter, but she's not going to approach her again. At least not for now. She's going to talk to her son, Raleigh. She's been asking around about him. By all accounts, he's a nice kid, a whiz with computers. He even had a little business last summer offering to fix people's computers. She wonders if he did any snooping then. She knocks on the door of 50 Finch, and a sullen-looking teenage boy answers. She recognizes him immediately as the drunken boy at the end of her driveway the other night. She can tell by his wary expression that he recognizes her, too. But she's not going to mention it. He's got dark hair and eyes, and he definitely reminds her of Luke at that age. She asks him if their house has been broken into recently, but he just looks at her as if she's grown two heads. So, instead, she asks him if he knows of any local boys around his age who might be good with computers. She's having problems with hers. Sure enough, he suggests Raleigh Sharp. At that moment, a woman arrives at the door, wiping her hands on a dish towel. She has short, auburn hair and freckles and a pleasant expression. Hello, can I help you? She asks as the boy slinks back inside. Hi, my name is Carmen. She holds her hand out. I'm new to the neighborhood. I'm at number 32. The woman gives her a smile, shakes her hand, and says, I'm Glenda. My kids are all grown, Carmen says, trying to make conversation. Nice-looking boy you have. She's not going to say where she's met her son before. Do you have other kids? She asks. No, just Adam, the woman says. She doesn't seem to want to talk. She probably wants to get back to her dishes. I was broken into recently, and I've been going around talking to people, telling them to be on their guard. There was no one home here last time I knocked. Well, we haven't been broken into, the woman says rather abruptly, her pleasant expression disappearing. Lucky you, Carmen thinks. That's good, she says, hiding her disappointment. Awful about that murder, Carmen says, thinking this will get the woman talking. She leans in conspiratorially. People seem to think that her husband did it, she adds. Do you know him? No, I don't. I actually knocked on his door just to find out if he's been broken into. I didn't have the nerve to say anything about his wife, but he hasn't. Well, it's nice meeting you, the woman named Glenda says, and shuts the door firmly. The phone rings, shattering the quiet. Olivia jumps. She grabs the phone in the kitchen, hoping it's Glenda. Hello? She says. Mrs. Sharp? She recognizes the voice. It's Detective Webb. Her heart immediately starts to pound, Yes, she says. Is your husband there? Wordlessly, she hands the phone to Paul, who is standing in the kitchen watching her. He takes the phone from her.
What?
Now? Paul says. Then,
fine.
Olivia feels a sickening jolt of adrenaline. Paul hangs up the phone and turns to her.
They want me to come down to the police station to answer some more questions.
She tastes the acid in her throat. Why?
They didn't say.
She watches him put on his jacket and leave the house. He doesn't ask her to come with him, and she doesn't suggest it. Once he's gone, Olivia gives in to her anxiety, pacing restlessly around the house, unable to quiet her mind. Why do the police want to talk to Paul again?
Mom, what's wrong?
She turns and sees Raleigh watching her with concern. She imagines how wretched she must look, caught off guard. She smiles at him.
It's nothing, honey, she lies.
She makes a sudden decision.
I just have to go out for a bit.
Where are you going?
I have to visit a friend who's going through a hard time.
Oh,
Raleigh says, as if not quite satisfied. He moves over to the refrigerator and opens the door.
Are you feeling okay?
He asks.
When will you be back?
I'm fine. I'm not sure exactly when I'll be back, Olivia says, but definitely in time for supper.
Raleigh is up in his bedroom when the phone rings. He wonders who's calling. Both his parents are out. Maybe it's one of his friends, reduced to looking up the family's landline number because he still doesn't have his phone. He makes it downstairs to the kitchen in time to snatch the phone off the hook. Hello? He says.
Hi.
It's a woman's voice.
May I speak to Raleigh Sharp?
Speaking? He says, suspicious.
I'm having some problems with my computer, and a neighbor told me that you might be able to help. You fix computers, don't you?
Yeah, sure,
Raleigh says, thinking fast. He didn't have many clients last summer after he distributed his flyers. He certainly didn't expect anybody to call now, but he's happy to earn some spare cash, and he's got time on his hands.
What's the problem?
Well, I don't know, she says. Can you come have a look at it?
Sure. Now?
If you can, that would be great.
What's your address?
It's a laptop. I thought we could meet in a coffee shop. Do you know the Bean?
Yeah, sure.
He wouldn't normally be caught dead in there, but he can make an exception. See you there in 15 minutes?
Okay,
Raleigh says.
I'll be wearing a red jacket, and I'll have my laptop with me, obviously, she says.
Raleigh hadn't even thought to ask how he'd recognize her, but she'll be watching for him, and teenage boys don't really hang out in those kinds of coffee shops where his mom and her friends go. Now that he's made the appointment, he's a little nervous. He's not really used to hiring out his services, but he's done a couple of small jobs before. He's never sure what to charge, but it should be easy enough. Sometimes all these housewives need to learn to do is turn the computer off, wait 10 seconds, and turn it on again. He grabs his jacket and heads for the coffee shop. Webb regards Paul Sharp, sitting across from him at the interview table. Sharp is perfectly still. He doesn't pick up the water from the table. Maybe he doesn't want them to see his hands shaking.
Thanks for coming in, Webb says. You're here voluntarily. You can leave at any time.
Sure. Webb doesn't waste any time. He tilts his head at Sharp doubtfully.
You know, I'm not buying it.
Not buying what? Sharp says. He folds his arms across his chest defensively.
That you were at your aunt's that Friday night.
Well, that's where I was, Sharp says stubbornly, whether you believe it or not.
We went to see your aunt, Webb says.
He lets a moment go by. She wasn't able to confirm that you were there that night.
No surprise there. I told you she didn't have a clue,
Sharp says. She has dementia.
You say you got home quite late, late enough that your wife was already asleep. Do you usually spend such a long time with your elderly aunt?
What is this? Am I a suspect? Paul asks.
We'd just like to clarify a few things.
He rephrases the question. How long do you usually spend with your aunt? Sharp exhales.
It's a fairly long drive, and I don't go very often, so when I do, I tend to stay a few hours, She's always asking me to do things for her, fix this and that. It usually takes a while. It's just that I'm afraid it puts you in the area where Amanda's car was found, Webb says, at around the time she is believed to have been murdered. And because your cell phone was turned off, we don't know where you were. I told you why I turned it off. My battery was dead. I had nothing to do with Amanda Pierce. You were seen in her car, arguing with her just days before she disappeared. You know why I was speaking to her, Sharp says. I told you the truth. I'm not the one who was having an affair with Amanda Pierce. He seems rattled. Do you know that area? Webb asks, where her car was found. I suppose so. He hesitates, and then adds, we have a cabin out there, on a small lake. Webb raises his eyebrows. You do? Yes, Sharp says. Where, exactly? It's at 12 Goucher Road, Spring Hill. Moen writes it down. How long have you had this cabin? Webb asks. Sharp shakes his head as if to show him how ridiculous he thinks this line of questioning is. We bought it when we were first married, about 20 years ago. Do you go out there much? Webb asks conversationally. Yes, we go on the weekends in good weather. It's not winterized. When was the last time you were out there? My wife and I went out a couple of weekends ago, October 7th and 8th, to start closing it up. Do you mind if we have a look at it? Sharp seems to freeze. Do you mind if we take a look? Webb repeats. As the silence lengthens, he says, we can always get a warrant. Sharp considers, looking back at him stonily. Finally, he says, go ahead. I've got nothing to hide. When Paul Sharp has left, even unhappier than when he came in, Webb turns to Moen. She raises both eyebrows at him. Lots of people probably have cabins out that way, Moen says. I'm sure they do. Webb agrees, but I want to get a look at this one. Moen nods. Webb says, he has squat for an alibi. Maybe he'd arranged to meet her at his cabin. The family wasn't going up that weekend. He had the story for his wife. The aunt called him, begging for a visit. If it's true, why did he go this time? He usually didn't. Why did he turn off his phone? He adds, and that cabin isn't very far from where she was found. He knows the area. He would know where to dump the car. He would, Moen agrees. Webb considers. In the meantime, let's get Larry Harris in here and confront him with this surveillance footage. Chapter 25. Olivia grips the steering wheel tightly as she drives over the bridge out of the city. She's going to visit her husband's Aunt Margaret. She knows where she lives, and she hasn't seen her in a long time. Raleigh saunters up to the door of the Bean, trying to look like a techie on the way to see a client, but he feels like a teenager meeting somebody else's mother. He doesn't feel confident at all. He's only 16. He reminds himself that he can probably fix her computer and get out of there within 15 minutes. And he can tell his mom, and she'll be happy that he did something useful. And maybe he can broach the subject of getting his phone back. He steps inside and immediately sees an older, blonde woman in a red jacket waving at him. Ugh, embarrassing. He quickly walks over and sits down across from her. He takes in the laptop. It's a Dell Inspiron, pretty basic. Hi, Raleigh, she says. It's nice to meet you. He nods awkwardly and says, hi. I'm Mrs. Torres, she says. Looking at her more closely, he can see that she's older than his mom. What's wrong with it? He asks, gesturing at the laptop. I can't get it to connect to the internet anymore. She flicks her hand at the machine in frustration. He pulls the laptop closer to him and looks at it. He quickly sees that it's in airplane mode. He hits the key with a little airplane on it. The internet connects to the Wi-Fi of the coffee shop automatically. You had it on airplane mode? He says, stifling a smirk. Jesus, Raleigh thinks. It's like taking candy from a baby. Oh, my goodness, is that all it was? The woman says. That's that, then, Raleigh says, feeling both relieved and disappointed there wasn't more wrong with the laptop. He can hardly expect to be paid for that. Hang on a minute, Raleigh, she says. He notes a sudden change in her tone of voice and is momentarily confused. She's holding a 20 in her hand, but she's not offering it to him. Now she leans closer. Her smile is still there, but it's changed. It's not genuine. She lowers her voice and says, "You broke into my house." Raleigh's face feels hot. His mouth has gone dry. It can't be the woman with the baby. This woman is too old. He doesn't know what to do. A long moment passes, and then he realizes that he must deny it.
What?
His voice is a dry croak. He clears his throat.
No, I didn't. I don't know what you're talking about.
But he knows he's not convincing. He looks guilty as hell, because he is guilty as hell.
Yes, you did. You snuck in and snooped around my house and in my computer, and I don't like it.
Why would I do that? Why do you think it was me? I never broke into your stupid house, he says like a terrified child. He is a terrified child.
I have no idea. You tell me. What were you looking for, exactly?
He shakes his head.
It wasn't me. I don't do that kind of stuff.
You can deny it all you want, but I'm on to you, Raleigh. He has to know how big a problem he's got here.
Maybe somebody broke into your house, lady, but what makes you think it was me?
Raleigh sputters, trying to keep his voice low. Because I know your mother wrote those letters.
What letters?
He's thinking fast. The letters of apology your mom wrote about you breaking into our houses. I got one of them, so I know it was you.
Raleigh feels a growing terror. She must be the one who spoke to his mom. His fingerprints are all over her house, and he's just handled her laptop. Fuck!
With a sudden, desperate bravado, he leans over the table toward her and speaks very clearly.
I was never in your house. Ever. You can't prove it. So back off and stay out of my way.
He can't believe he just spoke that way to an adult. He stands up.
I'm going.
She calls out after him, This isn't over! He can feel other people's startled eyes on him as he strides out of the coffee shop, his face burning. It's about an hour's drive to Aunt Margaret's place, worse in traffic. But it's Sunday afternoon and the traffic is light. As she drives, Olivia thinks about how pointless this trip probably is. Margaret won't remember if Paul visited her that night. She almost turns around and goes back home. But something keeps her driving forward along the highway and into the Catskills, and soon she arrives in Berwick. Margaret's house is a small bungalow, not as tidy as it used to be, but Margaret can't do much anymore. Olivia parks in the empty driveway. Margaret had given up her car a couple of years earlier, notices the fading paint, and knocks firmly on the front door. She wonders if anyone else will be there. For a long time, nothing happens. She rings the doorbell and knocks again. She has a terrible vision of Margaret, perhaps lying on the floor with a broken hip, unable to get to the door. She feels a sudden shame that she's taken so little interest in Paul's aunt's well-being, so busy with her own life. How often do people come to help her? Does she even have an alarm to use if she falls down? Finally, the door opens, and Margaret stands there blinking at her in the sunlight.
Olivia, she says in a weak, wavering voice. Her face breaks into a slow, surprised smile.
I wasn't expecting you, she says, out of breath after the effort of getting to the door.
It must be a good day, Olivia thinks. She knows the dementia comes and goes, that some days her head is clearer than others.
I thought you might like a nice visit, Olivia says, entering the house. Paul wanted to come, but he couldn't today, she says.
The old woman totters into the living room and sinks slowly into her rocking chair. She has the TV on low, with captions running along beneath. She reaches laboriously for the remote and turns it off. Now that she's here, Olivia is engulfed with sadness, that life comes down to this loneliness, this waiting. For supper time, for a visitor, for death. Olivia sits down on the sofa, turned toward Margaret. The air is stuffy, and she longs to open the windows, but thinks Margaret probably wouldn't like the draft.
Can I make you some tea? She asks.
That would be lovely, the old woman answers.
Olivia makes her way into the kitchen and fumbles around looking for the tea things. It doesn't take long. The kettle is on the stove, the tea bags are on the counter, and she finds the mugs in the first cupboard she opens. There's a carton of milk in the refrigerator. She sniffs it, and it seems okay. In fact, the fridge seems relatively well-stocked. When it's ready, she takes the tea out to the front room. "Tell me who you have coming in to help you," Olivia says. She listens patiently while Margaret tells her about her arrangements and how she hopes she gets into assisted living soon. "I imagine you like to have visitors," Olivia says. "I have a few," Margaret says. She names some friends who come regularly, if they can. "And Paul comes to see you sometimes," Olivia says, feeling a twinge of guilt about what she's doing. "Not very often," Margaret says darkly, the first hint of her petulant side. "I call him, but he never comes." "I'm sure he comes as often as he can," Olivia soothes. "The police came."
"Did they?"
Olivia asks, alert. "What did they want?"
"I don't remember." She slurps her tea. "You should come more," Margaret says. "You're good company."
"You probably don't remember the last time Paul was here," Olivia says.
"No," she says. "My memory isn't very good, you know."
Olivia's heart sinks. Margaret says slowly,
"That's why I keep a diary. I write in it a little every day to keep my mind sharp. The doctor said it would be good for me."
She points at a leather journal peeking out from underneath the newspaper on the coffee table.
"I write in it a little bit every day. The weather, who came to visit."
Olivia feels her heart begin to beat painfully.
"What a good idea. When did you start to do that?" "A while ago."
"Can I have a look?" Olivia asks. She must see what she wrote for September 29th. Margaret nods, and Olivia leafs through the pages, hoping to find the relevant date. But the diary is a mess. It's mostly blank, words scrawled in a shaky hand in the middle of the page, some random dates, but nothing makes any sense, barely a coherent sentence anywhere.
"Could you get us some more tea, Ruby, dear?"
the old woman asks. Chapter 26. Webb decides that Larry Harris doesn't look as confident in casual clothes. When Webb saw him last, he was still in his suit, his jacket off, his tie loosened, an executive back from a business trip. Today, he's wearing jeans and an old sweater, and he doesn't seem to have the same presence or authority. Or maybe it's that he's just not comfortable being brought in for questioning to the police station. That usually flusters people, especially if they have something to hide. Larry is staring at the table in the interview room. He has been read his rights. For now, he has declined to exercise his right to an attorney. "Larry, we know you were seeing Amanda Pierce." He closes his eyes. "Did your wife tell you what we have?" He nods. Webb waits for him to open his eyes. Finally, he does. He looks at Webb and says, "I saw her for a few weeks. We met sometimes at that hotel. I don't know what she told her husband." He flushes. "It was wrong. I know. I shouldn't have done it. I'm not proud of it." "We have the dates on the surveillance video," Webb says. "You saw her at the Paradise Hotel starting in July. You were with her there on the Tuesday before she disappeared, September 26th. No one saw her after the following Friday. So, what happened in that hotel room that night, Larry? Did she tell you it was over?" He shakes his head firmly.
"No, it was the same as usual. We were getting along fine."
He sits back in his chair, seems to deliberately assume a more open position.
"Look, it's not like we were in love. I wasn't planning on leaving my wife for her or anything. She wasn't putting pressure on me. It was just physical, for both of us."
"But now she's dead," Webb says.
"I didn't have anything to do with that," Larry says sharply. "Just because I slept with her doesn't mean I killed her."
"When was the last time you saw Amanda?" Webb asks.
"That night, at the hotel. She wasn't temping at our offices that week. She was at some accounting firm, she told me."
"When was the last time you spoke to her?" Webb asks. Larry hesitates briefly, as if considering a lie. That was the last time I spoke to her, he says. Webb doesn't believe him. He decides to let it go, for now. How did you communicate with Amanda? Did you call her at home? Webb asks. He knows he's needling him. No, of course not, Larry says, shifting uneasily in the hard chair. So, how did you communicate? Phone, Larry answers sullenly. What phone would that be? Webb asks. I had a separate phone for her. I see, says Webb. This would be an unregistered pay-as-you-go burner phone? Larry nods reluctantly. And did Amanda have a second unregistered phone as well? He nods again. Yes. Webb glances quickly at Moen. They haven't found her burner phone. They found her regular cell phone and her purse in the car, but no burner phone is turned up. They need to find that phone. He focuses in on Larry again. Do you have any idea where it might be? No. And where is your burner phone now? I don't have it anymore. Why not? After Amanda disappeared, I didn't need it anymore, and I didn't want my wife to find it. How did you get rid of it? Larry takes so long to answer that Webb repeats the question. How did you get rid of it? I didn't kill her, Larry insists suddenly. What did you do with the burner phone? I threw it into the Hudson, he says nervously. I went for a walk along the river one night and tossed it in. And when was that? It was about a week after she'd left. I mean, everybody thought she'd taken off on her husband. Webb stifles his frustration. He'll never find that phone, or Amanda's phone either. His bet is that she had it with her when she was murdered and her killer got rid of it. Same as the murder weapon. He shifts gears. Why can't we find anybody who saw you at the resort on Friday afternoon? After you checked in, nobody saw you until around 9 o'clock. Larry exhales heavily, looks from Webb to Moen and back again. I worked in my room all afternoon and then fell asleep. I missed most of the reception. And we're supposed to believe that? Webb asks. It's true, Larry says, almost violently. Why don't you check with the resort? I never left my room, I swear. They must have cameras on the parking lot. They can tell you that my car never left. Where did you park your car? Webb already knows Larry didn't park in the indoor parking lot at the resort. He's had people watch all the tapes. In the outdoor lot, to the right of the hotel? Right. We've checked, and there are no cameras there, apparently, only in the indoor parking area. He adds, as I'm sure you know. Larry looks frightened now. I didn't, he protests. How would I know that? Webb says quickly, did you know that Amanda was pregnant? He shakes his head, frowning, off balance. No, I didn't know. Honest, I always used a condom. She insisted on it. She didn't want to get pregnant, he says angrily. Why don't you arrest her husband? If anyone killed her, it was him. She told me once that if he ever found out that she was cheating on him, he would kill her. He adds regretfully, I didn't believe her at the time. I should have. Webb looks carefully at Larry and tries to tell if he's lying. Webb thinks Robert Pierce is capable of murder, but he wonders if Larry is making this up. Robert Pierce is a cold son of a bitch, Larry says. Amanda told me about him, how he treated her. She told me that she would leave him someday, so when she disappeared, I thought that's what she'd done. If anyone killed her, it was her husband. Webb stares him down. There's something else, Larry says finally. Robert Pierce, he knew about me and Amanda, and he knew she had a burner phone. How do you know that? Webb asks, alert. Because I got a call from her burner phone, and it was Robert on the other end. He said, Hi, Larry, it's her husband, Robert. I hung up. When was that? Webb asks. It was the day she disappeared, Friday, September 29th, around 10 in the morning. Webb meets Moen's eyes. Chapter 27. Becky Harris stares out the glass doors to the backyard. She'd wanted to accompany Larry to the police station when the detectives came to bring him in for questioning, but he insisted that she stay here.
She could tell he was worried. They're both plenty worried. When she'd returned from the police station and told Larry about the video surveillance of him at the Paradise Hotel, he'd looked so panicked that she didn't even bother to say, "What did I tell you, you idiot?" Instead, she said, "They're going to bring you in for questioning." She'd had to steel herself to stop her body trembling. "Larry," she said, "tell me the truth. Did you kill her?" He looked back at her, an expression of shock on his exhausted face. "How can you even think? How can I think it?" she stormed at him. "The evidence, Larry, it's piling up against you. You were having an affair with her. It's on tape. You were in the area near the lake where her body was found and can't account for your whereabouts. God help you if they find out you argued with her on the day before she went missing. And then you go and throw your phone off the Skyway early Sunday evening on the way back from the resort before anyone even knew she was missing. I don't know, Larry, but you look guilty as hell." "I didn't know she was dead when I tossed the phone," he protested. He grabbed her arms and said, "Becky, I had nothing to do with this. You have to believe me. I know how bad it looks, but I didn't hurt her. It must have been Robert. He knew she was cheating on him. He found her burner phone. He called me from it, and I answered. He already knew about me and Amanda. He said, 'Hi, Larry,' before I even opened my mouth. He must have killed her." "So Robert did know." She nodded slowly. "He must have," she agreed. She forced herself to take deep breaths. When she looked at her husband, she couldn't believe, even in the face of all the circumstantial evidence, that he could actually have killed someone, that he could have beaten a woman to death. "When you talk to the police, you have to tell them all that," she said at last. "But tell them you threw the phone into the river someplace from the shore, in case there are cameras on the bridge. They could check them and see when you did it. Tell them it was a few days after she disappeared, not the same weekend." He nodded back at her, obviously terrified, relying on her now to help him. She was thinking more clearly than he was. "And whatever you do, don't tell them you had an argument with Amanda the day before she went missing," she said, "and that she'd broken it off with you." Then the detectives had come to take him down to the station for questioning, and she'd worked herself into this frenzy of doubt and fear. She doesn't think Larry is capable of planning a cold-blooded murder. If he was, he wouldn't be in this mess. But a moment of uncontrolled anger? Could he have struck Amanda in a rage, not meaning to kill her? She's afraid that might be exactly what happened, and that Larry is lying to her still and frightened for his life. Her mind strays uneasily to an incident that happened a couple of years ago. Their daughter, Christy, was being harassed by a teenage boy whom she refused to date. He kept bothering her at school, and then he made the mistake of coming around the house, calling her names. Larry had charged out of the house and rammed the boy up against the wall so fast it had made Becky's head spin. She still remembers the fear and shock on the boy's face. And how Larry looked, his left hand grasping the boy's shirt by the collar, his right hand drawn back as if he were about to punch the kid hard in the face. Christy was crying behind her inside the house, but something stopped him. He shoved the boy down the driveway and told him to leave his daughter alone. Becky had worried that the kid might press charges, but they never heard from him again. Now she forces herself to thrust the incident from her mind, returning to the present. Robert is the cold-blooded type. She thinks now that he might be quite capable, smart enough, calculating enough to plan a murder and carry it out. And if he did, she's pretty sure he would know how to do it so that he never got caught. She has to know who killed Amanda. Was it Robert or her husband? Impulsively, she leaves her own house, crosses the lawn, and knocks on Robert's front door. As she waits, she looks nervously over her shoulder, wondering if any of the neighbors are watching her. She knows he's home. She'd seen him passing in front of the windows earlier, and his car is in the driveway. She's about to turn away, defeated. But then the door opens. He stands there looking at her. His mouth doesn't quirk up in that charming smile of his. They're done with all that. "Can I come in?" she asks.
"What for?"
"I need to talk to you." He seems to consider it for a moment. What's in it for him? But she sees curiosity get the better of him. He steps back and pulls the door open. It's only when he closes it behind her that she realizes that maybe she's been stupid. She's a little afraid of him. She doesn't really think he's going to harm her. He wouldn't dare under the circumstances. But what does she expect to learn? It's not like he's going to tell her the truth. All at once, she's tongue-tied. She doesn't know how to start.
"What did you want to talk about?" he says, folding his arms across his chest, looking down at her.
He's much taller than she is. They're still standing in the front hall.
"Larry's at the police station," she says. "They seem to think that he might have killed Amanda."
She's tried to say it bluntly, but her voice has a quiver in it.
"Because he was having an affair with her," Robert says, matter-of-factly.
She stares back at him, nods slowly.
"That's why you slept with me, isn't it? You knew Larry was sleeping with Amanda all along, so you slept with me."
"Yes," he says. He smiles. He seems to be enjoying himself. How could she have been so seduced by him? There's no sign of that warmth and boyishness that charmed her anymore. But it doesn't matter. She's over that now. He doesn't seem to care that she knows. If he killed his wife, he must be very sure now of not getting caught.
"Larry's going to tell the police," she says, "that you knew about them. He told me about the burner phone, that you called him on it."
"I'm not worried," Robert says. "He has no proof. It's his word, and yours, against mine."
She looks up at him. He seems to tower over her now. She feels small. He could snap her neck with his hands if he wanted to.
"Larry didn't kill her," she says. "You can't possibly know that," he says. "In fact, I think you're worried that he did kill her."
"I think it was you," she whispers, goaded into saying it.
"You can think what you like," Robert says, "and tell the police whatever you want. But they know you'd say anything to protect your husband."
"Do you have an alibi?"
she asks desperately.
"Not really," he admits.
"You killed her," Becky says wildly, as if repeating it will make it true. Robert leans in close to her, so his face is just inches from hers.
"Well, it was probably one of us," he says icily. "And you don't know which one. I guess you have a problem, don't you?"
Becky stares back at him for a moment in horror, and then sweeps past him, yanks open the door, and flees back to her own house.
Chapter 28. When Olivia returns home from her drive to Margaret's, she's exhausted. The house is quiet.
"Where have you been?" Paul asks. He's sitting in the living room, a drink in his hand.
She looks back at him warily, ignoring his question.
"Where's Raleigh?"
"He's in his room."
"What did the police want, Paul?"
Olivia asks nervously. She sits down beside him while he tells her what happened at the police station.
"Why do they want to see the cabin?" she asks in disbelief.
"I don't know."
"Well, they must have said something, given some reason."
She feels her anxiety skyrocket. When he answers, he sounds irritated.
"Like I said, they asked me if I was familiar with the area where her body was found, and I had to tell them about our cabin. How would it look if I didn't, and they found out afterward?"
He looks at her steadily.
"I have nothing to hide, Olivia."
He certainly doesn't sound paranoid. He sounds like he thinks this is an inconvenience, an intrusion, nothing more.
"No, of course not," she says.
"They said if I didn't give consent, they would get a warrant."
Paul crosses his arms in front of him as he tells her,
"It was like a threat. I should have said no on principle. Let them get their fucking warrant."
"We have nothing to hide, Paul," Olivia says uneasily. "We should just let them go ahead. They won't find anything, and then they'll leave us alone."
He glares at her.
"You know how I feel about this sort of thing. It's an outrage. It really is."
She slumps tiredly. She has no energy left. She doesn't want him to be difficult about this.
"But you told them yes, didn't you?" she asks.
If he makes a fuss about this, she might really have cause for alarm. She might think he's actually hiding something, and they'll get the warrant anyway.
"Yes," Paul says at last. "There's nothing to find. It's not like we're hiding anything. But it's ridiculous, and a waste of resources. It's not a good thing that police can ask to search your home, knowing that they'll just get a warrant anyway. It's intimidation. It's an erosion of privacy."
"I know how you like your privacy," Olivia says, a hint of acid in her voice. He turns on her. What's that supposed to mean?
It just means I don't see why you have to be difficult about this. I want this to end, Paul.
I'm not being difficult, Paul says tersely. They're meeting me out there tomorrow morning. I'm taking the day off work.
She feels her body sag. She just wants to be done with this. And she's not going to tell Paul about her visit to his Aunt Margaret.
Raleigh can hear raised voices on the floor below. It sounds like his parents are arguing, but the voices quickly recede. He couldn't make out what they were saying. It's not like his parents to argue, but lately the house has been tense. He blames some of it on himself. He knows his parents are fighting partly because of what he's done. He doesn't dare tell them about what happened this afternoon at the coffee shop, how that horrible woman tracked him down, tricked him, and accused him. It took him ages to stop shaking afterward. If he told his parents, his mother would probably have a breakdown. But what if that woman shows up at the house and confronts his mother again and tells her about the meeting in the coffee shop? What if she decides to go to the police? He feels trapped, and he doesn't know what to do. The only people he would feel comfortable going to for help or advice for anything are his parents, and he can't go to them with this. Not now. Not with everything else they're dealing with. And they all continue to pretend that everything is just fine. Becky bolts inside her house and locks the door behind her. Now that she's away from him, she begins to shake. Only a psychopath would toy with her the way Robert just did. It was probably one of us, and you don't know which one. I guess you have a problem, don't you? What kind of person would say something like that when it's his own wife who's dead? He's sick. She realizes with a hideous feeling that Robert wants Larry to be charged with the murder of his wife. After all, Larry was the one sleeping with her. Perhaps he set the whole thing up somehow. He doesn't miss Amanda at all. He put on a good show of grief in the beginning, but he's not bothering to pretend for her anymore. He's let her see who he really is. He's dropped the mask. She paces the living room anxiously, picking relentlessly at her cuticles. She hears a key in the lock. Larry comes in and looks at her.
Why do you have the door locked? He asks, his face gray.